been sick, but she was sick for nearly 10 years and was in the hospital a lot. And she was in the hospital, and right after dinner, you know, they always expect them to sleep, you know, after. So I says to her, now I says, while you're taking a nap, I'll go over and interview Mrs. Chamberlain. Mrs. Harvey Chamberlain was one of the very first settlers that ever came to Standish. She was 98 years old at the time. And I had known her back in 1978. They had what they call county normals here, and I went through county normal, you know. They didn't have any colleges close by, the Ferris Institute and the county normals. They didn't call it Central University at that time, you know. So I went to county normal first, and I got acquainted with some of the Chamberlain girls. So I went over there, knocked at the door, and Mrs. Chamberlain was 98 years old, and she'd been blind for 7 years, and had one of these walkers to walk around the house. She had a housekeeper there with her. And I says, how do you do, Mrs. Chamberlain? And she knew my voice after 25 or 30 years. Well, come right on in, Mr. Ennis, and take a chair. Now, she just knew that voice and sat down just like we are here, got to visiting. And I says, I want to get some of the early history of Aranai County. I says, you were here, I says, before it was a county. Came here in 1872 is when she came as a little girl here. And then she sat down and told me the story of Saguenay and all of the early things. And she says, did you know that Harvey's life was saved, that's her husband's life, was saved by the Indians when he was a little boy? And he says that it was during the Civil War. It was when there was only 5 white people that Harvey Chamberlain came, and they lived with the Indians of Saguenay. And there was a little store over at Pine River at that time, and the folks sent him across the ice in March over to Pine River to get some provisions. He had a little sled, and he got that, and it was only 4 or 5 miles across the ice there. So that he went over there, and as he was coming back, one of these blizzards came up in March. And he was just, well, nobody would know where there was, but one old Indian had seen him going across there and knew that. And he went out and found him in there. He was about frozen to death. He saved his life, took him cold water and revived him, and at last took him home on the sled with the provision. But he saved Harvey's life. Well, Harvey says, I'm going to do something for that. Well, then Harvey Chamberlain, when Aranai County became a county, he was the first register of deeds of the county, and he became one of the first bankers in the county, became wealthy, owned the Standish Bank. So what he thought he'd do for the Indians, he would write or have written the history of the Ojibwas, not only of this county, but from Saginaw, that's down where you are, all up through there. So then she says, you know, that Harvey had Indians working for him on that history for several years, but he never had it published. So I says, well then, I says, where is it? Well, she said, I had it. She said, I had all the history of Pine River. Nobody ever asked for any of it. I burnt that up. But says, that history of the Indians, the Ojibwas, that Harvey had written, she said, I gave it to my daughter, Ida. And she was 83 years old. His daughter was 83. Gave it to her daughter, Ida. She was 98, other was 83. And she said, she's got it. That's what I gave it to her. So, well, I said, that's all right. So a few days later, I went over to see Ida then. I visited with her, and she told me about this first train coming Standish in 1872 on July the 1st, and all a lot of that story. And Harvey, when he worked on the boom at Saguenay, that there's big calluses on his hand. He never could open one hand up. You know, he got calluses from a pipe pole. Wasn't running that so much. And made that, and he never could open his hand so well afterwards from using so much pipe bowls as a boy when he went through there. But anyhow, I went over to Ida Forsyth, and this used to be the druggist, her husband. He is dead. It was a hot day. Yes, she says, I've got a lot of stuff of Dad's up there. Mother gave to me. It's up in the attic, and it's too hot for me. See, she was 83, and she didn't want to be climbing upstairs up in the attic on a hot day. But says, I'm going up to Crystal Lake this summer and spend the summer up there, but when it comes back cooler in the fall, you come back over and I'll go up there and get those manuscripts. So I had to wait then till fall. She'd been visiting there and came back. Sure enough, she had a lot of stuff, but she says, you know, that manuscript of that Indians. Come to think about it, after I looked all there through it, I had given it to an old Indian lady. Oh, I says, whom did you give it to? Well, she says, I gave it to a KB, one of the KBs. She says, great friends of ours, and she wanted to read it, and I gave it to her. Well, I says, where is she? Why, she says, she belongs on the little reservation over at Saguenay, but the last few years, she's getting crippled up, so she stayed at the Farmer's Hotel here in Standish. Why, I says, and that's nothing to it. I'll go over to the Farmer's Hotel and get that. So I went over to the, waited the next day, and went on over to the hotel. Yes, Mrs. Cavey had stayed there, but she'd been dead for 3 years. So there I'd lost out again, or I thought I had lost out. Well, I says, dead, yeah. And I thought, well, I said, did they have an Indian? Yeah, an Indian funeral, buried here, yes. I says, who was the undertaker? Well, it says the one right in Standish. So then I took another trip over to the undertaking parlor. I says, did you bury it? Yes, but we can't remember when, but give us a week and we'll look up the records for you. So they looked up the records and told me who it was. There was to have been some Indian from Seattle, Washington, who was to have conducted the funeral, but he didn't show up, so another KB and somebody else from Kokolan had charge of the funeral. And last, they looked it up, and in their records, they found out the address was on Euclid there in Bay City. So I says, well, I'll go down and interview them then. I started to look right where the K-mark is, about where the address was. Well, I says, this is no Indian. I know enough about Indians. There wouldn't be any Indians living around where this K-mark is. If anyone knows the way they live, they wouldn't live in a place like that if you gave it to them. They wouldn't stay there. So, but I kept right on going up Euclid, and sure enough, there's a north and south, but they didn't mention that. Mm-hmm. And renumbered, when you get up at the Kokolan River, there is still a little Indian settlement and a little Indian church up there. And here was this KB, Mamie KB, that had been given to her at last. And I don't think she'd ever looked at it. There was the old trunk and so on. And there was an Isaac, he was a preacher there. And he had looked at some of it. He says, I know that some parts has been missing. It isn't all there. He said, it isn't all there. But I could see I was a stranger and I wasn't making too much headway about asking to come right in as a stranger to give you something that you had in the trunk, and I wasn't getting very far. So I just dropped my subject right away. I could see I wasn't going to get anything out of that. I could tell by their attitude. So I commenced talking. When I was a boy, I lived with the Indians up on the river here. Amos Greenburn, he stayed with our place, and Frank Odwig Navy. He and some of the others had hunted and fished right down by our place. Jim Coon had me working for him. He was supposed to be an Indian chief, and I'd worked with him, and I'd been around with the Indians, and I didn't know, but I made up my mind that she knew every one of them, and she did. I just commenced talking about the Coons and the Odwig Navies and the Greenbird and so on, and at last, without anything, says, you can have them for 3 days and no longer. Well, there I had all of this stack, and there's some of that paper is so brittle that if you just bend it, it'd break. It's over 100 years old, you see. Mm-hmm. Some of it, maybe 150, because there were some older papers that had been gathered in there. Well, then after I got them, I didn't know what to do with them. There's no place in Aranac County when you get up here, there's no place for duplication. Don't have any machines or anything like that. Now I said, what am I going to do? It's all legal-sized paper. So I went up to the regional library. I thought maybe they'd have it. That's up at Alabaster. We have a Tri-County Regional Library. I says, they might have a duplicating machine there. Well, they didn't have it there, but when they saw it, it says, you've got something priceless there. Says, there isn't anything in the United States on Indian history where you can find a genealogy of the Indians of any particular locality for 200 years, and that's, you can go back for as high as 8 or 10 generations if you study that out. So, says, it's priceless, and we'll get it done, and we'll have it back so you can get it back in time, and we'll pay for it. Well, then they went up to the D&M Railroad offices, and there they have duplicating machines there that could handle it. It cost $110, and the state of Michigan paid for it, so that helped me out of $110 to get those things duplicated. Well, I said, I want a copy, and the library wanted a copy, and they sent one copy to the State Library at Lansing, so there were the three copies. But since that time, why, the University of Michigan's been up after for copies, and so they have at Michigan State College, and all of those colleges is getting copies of that. That shows you how important this stuff is. For, I don't know whether you've got any copies at Saginaw Valley or not, but all of these others have got copies of that, don't you see? Somebody who can get a doctor's degree on that sometime if they know the language well enough, because every one of those words has a meaning in Ojibwa. If they get that and know it well enough so they can, you could write a thesis on that, because you can go back of Ogamalka Quito and the Treaty of 1819 and all these, I guess you saw some of these Indian treaties in there. You could go right back with that and get those and make a study, don't you see, if you once understood it. But that's something for somebody else beyond me. You can make a study of that and get it. Because I found out that the language that the Ojibwas hear isn't the same as the language that they use in the Upper Peninsula. We have a dialect down here. It isn't exactly the same as it is in the Upper Peninsula. Mrs. Siler says she's gone to camp meetings up there with her husband and can hardly understand a word of it. She says they sing song and they don't speak exactly the same Ojibwa there as they do down here. So that's...
Are the Ojibwa and Chippewa terms interchangeable?
Yes. In fact, that's some more, as I said, Schoolcraft, another white man, has given those names as interchangeable. The Ojibwa, Ottawa, Potawatomi, and a number of others, are, if you know their language well, they can understand one another, different dialects of the same thing. Now, Mrs. Siler says the Ottawas, although you've studied your Indian history and it shows the Ottawas over in Canada and where the different places they were, but primarily all it means is trader. In English, the word Ottawa just means the Indians that traded. They might have had some of the same characteristics, did some hunting and fishing, but primarily they were the ones that was buying and selling. And for instance, they had tobacco over in Canada. The best tobaccos would have to be brought from there and traded for something else over here. So they ones that...
They still grow it there in Ontario.
Oh, surely.
Near Brantford and...
Grow it in some tobacco fields, they still grow it there. And you see, there it is, again, when you study history, you can't study really the history of Saginaw Valley. You'll have to know the history of eastern United States, because the Iroquois, they got guns and ammunition, and there was trouble between them and the French, and it was the guns and so on that drove the Indians out. It was the guns that the English had given to the Iroquois, and that made them powerful, and they could come over here, and the Huron and Wyandots, the same thing, you know. They called them Huron in Canada, and Wyandots on this side of the rivers, and another term that is used. Well, each one was shoving the other, so they call it the Iroquois, and they did invade here, and the Indians mostly went on farther west for a few years, you know. Most of them got clear over into Wisconsin, even as far west as into the Dakotas to avoid them, and Mackinac was abandoned and all of that for the Iroquois, you know, in those invasions. Well, back of it all was the battle between if we know our Queen Anne's War and the various wars in Europe that brought on over into America, it was affecting the Indians and the settlers here, when you take it in the broader sense of the word, don't you see? I know you boys, I've read about half of all of that historical collection up there. Have you ever read all the Cadillac papers and the Alamon papers and all of the squabbles you don't realize how much squabble and how much squabbles there was between the fur traders. You read those old stories. One fur company trying to get the best of the other one, and cheating and so on between them.
It was the only wealth that was available.
That was the only wealth wealth available at the time. That was it. Yes, I'm doing something like you are with a tape recorder. I've got tape recorders and I've got old timers and the tapes there of the early days. And there I got, I don't know how many records, enough to last for hours just of this country through here, of tape recordings. But I have never been able to get a tape yet out of the Indians. I've tried it, and they speak so low I can't get it to the tape. It'll have to be a one that's super sensitive or something that don't seem to get all the...
Up to Mrs. Silas, you know, the one that still speaks the Chippewa. She's one of the few who does, and we just couldn't get anything at all. And Brigham, where they're not about to tell you.
No, I used that same tape recorder when I went down there to the college, and I just sent it there in the room. I could hear everything that... They're said in the room, but their voice is so.
And she hasn't been well, has she, Mrs. Silas?
I haven't been up there since we were up there, a couple, 3 months ago. I haven't And she's getting old, you know.
Is she really? No.
But you know, as I say, the meaning of the Indian words. I sat there and we had Eli Moses and Leslie James. Now, when we say Eli Moses and Leslie James, that's what we white people call them. That isn't their Indian name at all. You know, Indians had three names. One that they were christened by that they seldom used, then the regular rest of the Indians called them, then what the white man called them. So when we say, but Eli Moses, and I know I asked how Saguenay got its name. Well, then he explained that the verb Sagan, that isn't pronouncing it, but that's the way we say it in English, means to swish back and forth, a form of killing by swishing back and forth. An ing or wing on the end means a place where. So then he said, years and years ago, the wild pigeons were so numerous at what's now Saguenay, that the Indians used to take poles and they'd just swish them rapidly back and forth through the air. Then they'd scare these pigeons up, and as they were flying over, they'd knock them down by the hundreds, and that's the way they'd kill their wild pigeons and get them to eat. But it says the white man put up nets and
got them off.
They were much more efficient.
Yeah, much more efficient. In fact, they killed them all. That's what they did. They did the same thing with the grayling.
Do you want some coffee?
That's hot. I don't like things. Give me a glass of cider or something like that. I don't like hot drinks. I know it's warm, it's all right. But hot, I don't care much about hot drinks.
Did you give the old manuscript back to the family?
Huh?
Did you take the manuscript back after the 3 days?
Oh, yes, I got it. That's one thing that you want your words. They don't trust you too much to start with. That's one thing that you want to be exactly on time or ahead of time. I may not think it makes any difference, but it does if you want to get anywhere. That's one thing. They're so bitter and you can't blame them for bitter the way the treatment that they've had. Practically everything the white man's done has been wrong, as far as that. And that book there, you don't see it published in histories, but to tell how they took the Indians and sent them to the reservations.
Which one is that?
You'll find stories in Michigan.
Yeah,
you'll find them in there. Of how they first they'd catch some of the babies. Get those, that'd be the soldiers first. Well, then the mother would naturally try to save her baby, and then they'd get her, and then they'd get some of the other children. They didn't always get the man, but they usually eventually would get him, but it might take a long time. Then they let them starve to death before they got them out to Kansas or Oklahoma. The treatment that they have is a thing that John's folks was all sent to Oklahoma too, wasn't it? That's where his folks were sent out there, the Cherokees, wasn't it?
No,
that's where they came from Oklahoma at one time, their relatives I know
of. Yeah, but that was after his grandmother was born in Indiana. Yeah.
Well, as I say, that they were in Oklahoma, I know that at one time.
We lived in southern Indiana.
Blackbird, or Maca de Penasi, that would be what it would be in English, wrote the history of the Ottawas. And it tells, you know, the story of the crooked tree and the big kettle. So last week, my brother, I was up at Tower. And then we went over to Petoskey, and from Petoskey we went over to Harbor Springs, and we followed Lake Michigan over to Wagonance Point. Wagonance means little fox in English. And there's that old Indian, all of those. Then it comes back to you. You can see the hills and so on after reading that. Then going back through there, then you can see the story with how you give it over there along the lake. It's so green, you know, that no frost yet, because that Lake Michigan must protect it up for a mile.
It keeps it warm for about an extra month. That's why it's so much fruit grows there.
Well, I was wondering, you boys are connected with the teaching, if we could gradually get manuscripts, and a lot of them wouldn't object if they got stories and you could get parts of them, of different ones, and just keep building them up the way on. As I said, this opium happened, he had to make lots of money. It wasn't what he put in the paper, what he kept out. They'd pay him, if he'd get a little luscious piece of news, they'd have to pay, he'd tell them about it, and they'd pay him so much not to print it. He could print it so he could ruin a person's reputation if necessary. But he says Loud, you know, he was our congressman there for quite a while, but for some reason or other, he said, well, he had the newsboys when Loud was coming. Loud lived up here at Oscoda. Coming down, and they had the newsboys. He only printed 5 or 6 sheets, but they thought they had all about Grandma Loud, you know, as if it was politics time. Well, he wanted to know whether, said, just out off the press. Well, how much would it cost to stop that edition, buy that all up? Well, it was $1,200. They had only printed 4, but they got that $1,200 out of him because they were about the biggest scandals they've got now in Washington today. About the same thing as working on in those days, all about Grandma Loud.
Where did Mr. Moran get his opium?
Well, I got it right from the doctors, is where the most of them, the doctors at that time, just peddled it right out. Dr. Petty used to have about $10,000 worth sitting right out in the front. Nobody knew what it was.
Was he sick to get him started on that? Huh? Had he been sick or something to get him started on that?
Well, I don't know. He had it when he came here. He had that habit. He had it. That's why he lost his job in these other places, was his dope habit. And he certainly had it come. He had a commander. He was. You wouldn't know it, you know, unless he told you what he had.
Do you have a copy of the first volume of the Aeronautic History that you printed?
No, I have never printed it. I have not printed it in. I haven't printed it in book form yet. But up there is 25 articles right there. It's in all of those over there. Those Michigan Heritage.
Those
are all 25 of them.
The ones that you said that the state would copy the articles for?
But you can get work
in
historical.
This is what I had the index. You copy the index.
Huh?
This is what you...
Time, this light was burning there, and the snow was coming down, and there was a steady light off of Point Lookout, or Charity Island. The East Tallwash light was a blinking light. Well, the snow was coming over the windows, and the lighthouse keeper thought, well, now they can't see the light. Some boat will get wrecked on the rocks here. So we went out and commenced wiping that light off. And as he's wiping it off, a boat coming from the north thought it was East Tallwash. As he'd wipe it, that'd make the light appear to blink. They veered to the east, and the boat's wrecked there today. Hit wrecked by, while he was trying to wipe the snow off, it just caused a boat wreck. That's years ago in Charity Island. And then there's often thought that the Griffin might have was anchored. There's some theory that you'll remember the first boat that sailed the Great Lakes and so on, that they made that. And old Clem, I think it was, or so on there, he wasn't the only one that wasn't too religious. So the rest of them didn't quite, most of the time they were praying when they ought to have been doing a little more work, and got in one of those. And there's stories that they used the Charity Islands as the lee on when they were going up. Of course, it never did get back, so far as we know. They've never found it yet, have they? I haven't heard it.
Almost every little point along the coast claims that the Griffins...
Well, it could have been. They probably did when he went up. Mm-hmm. Could have been up there, because I don't think they ever got too far out from shore. But when they came back, we don't know where they went.
Seems like it would probably be in Lake Michigan rather than in Lake Huron.
There's a question there from Green Bay on. This is, I don't know.
They were supposed to meet them down there, well, where St. Joseph's is.
Yeah.
Is today, the mouth of the river. But
you get a lot of that in those papers there. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize there was so much antagonism between LaSalle and Cadillac and so on. They had a lot of enemies, you know. It wasn't all roses and sunshine when you know their personal lives, and there was jealousy between there and Quebec and so on. And our histories, of course, that ordinary histories don't print that. Did you get their letters and correspondence and so on that they had between one another? Well, if anybody that likes it, that's good reading, you know, to know the general trend of things all the way through.
Yeah, they were all here to make money.
Yeah, that's what they were. And they made it certainly in the furs, in the fur business. There was a big profit in it.
You know, it's kind of funny when you read through that stuff, you think of people like Cadillac and LaSalle, and, maybe not so much the missionaries, but mainly the traders. You, you tend to glorify their names because they lived a long time ago and they were the first people to go through here and they did such daring things. But when you sit down and read their letters, you find out that they were pretty much like the people that are around today.
Not very much difference. They had their troubles and so on to get along there. I know that you probably, there's another book, I think they call Michigami or something like that, published by Kohl, K-O-H-L, and he gives a pretty good idea of life among the Indians, particularly the Upper Peninsula. But he gives there, and there's another Indian writer, well, he was a young Indian, almost, well, he died when he was only about 28 years old, but he tells the meaning of a lot of the, for instance, he tells that wah-wah, that's the verb wave. Well, Mrs. Silas had told me that, the verb wave, like wah-wah tam. That's equal to angry waves in one way of interpreting it. If it waves or anything, wild goose is a wah-wah too because it waves its wings. Up here in Canada they have wah-wah and they've got the picture of a goose there. It's the verb to wave, you see. Well, then when the priests came, the Jesuits, well then the way the Indian interpreted, they was waving the stick, the man that waved wah-wah-matic-wanywig. That is the man that waves the stick. That is the, what they call him, you see. Wah-wah was the wave, and matic is the wood. Man that waved the wooden stick. That's the way they take the verbs, don't you see, and put it through in that way.
Language is very different than ours because it builds up. Like,
yeah.
German is similar. You end up with very long words because they're always putting nouns and adjectives and things together. And you come up with 42-letter words because it's all built up together. I don't know exactly what you would call it, but we have a word for almost everything, and many of our words mean 5 or 10 or even 11 different things. But we don't build them together.
Well, you take it with the Ojibwa. They had much more fluent in terms of water and woods. They had more words than we had. As far as trees and flowers and fish and so on. Of course, the millions of words or thousands of words we have, they didn't exist at all. But they had, so far as the fishing, we always, only 5 or 6 ways we'll say that we fish, with a hook and line or so on. But they had many more ways and words for those that they used in that language. That's why these old Indians are telling me they used many more words for explaining fishing and hunting. But then on the other hand, they don't have any words at all that for lots of words that we used didn't exist at all, had no use for them.
What did they call themselves? Did they think of themselves as a people?
Yes. Yeah, they've got a name. It's a big, long name, too, right? Yeah, they thought of themselves as a people, but I've never been able to pronounce the name. It's a long name that they call themselves. It's one of those names, as you said, where they run it together. And
does it have any meaning in English?
I don't know if I've seen that. Warren, it's in this Warren's History of the Chippewas. You'll find it in there. It'll explain it in there.
Where did this dictionary come from, Mr.
Dennis?
The one in Detroit, the English Chippewa in...
That one is better than... I've got both dictionaries there. You know where I got that? I've spent weeks in the Burton Historical Collection. And that couldn't, you know, there's places in those big libraries where anything can't be out or anything, and there's one of those rare Ojibwa dictionaries. So I had them photostat the whole thing. It cost me quite a lot, but I had them, the whole dictionary. It cost me some money, but there it is, the Ojibwa, English Ojibwa. And that's simple. That's much better. I don't like, I paid $17 for that Abaraga's dictionary. I've got his Indian dictionary. Yeah, just let this fellow see. Have you ever seen that Indian dictionary? English, but now he's got so much Latin and so on there. I paid $17 for that one. And that's a reprint, don't you see? I sent up to Minneapolis and got Hazel Lavoie told me whereabouts to get this one. So I got that one there. So that's the, but that runs, isn't as simple as this one right here. So I had them send it that way, and that's the way I got this.
It's a good place to start.
Yeah, I've spent weeks there in libraries like that.
Right there, Stanley. He had the Burton Historical Society. I had to get to the college.
that Berger, you know, Bishop Berger, well, he was...